This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Presumed Innocent. Written by Scott Turow. Read by Edward Herman.
Opening Statement. This is how I always start. I am the prosecutor. I represent the state. I am here to present to you the evidence of a crime. Together you will weigh this evidence. You will deliberate upon it. You will decide if it proves the defendant's guilt. This man, and here I point. You must always point, Rusty, I was told by John White. That was the day I started in the office. The sheriff took my fingerprints, the chief judge swore me in, and John White brought me up to watch the first jury trial I'd ever seen. Ned Halsey was making the opening statement for the state, and as he gestured across the courtroom, John, in his generous, avuncular way, with the humid scent of alcohol on his breath at 10 in the morning, whispered my initial lesson. He was the chief deputy PA then, a hale Irishman with white hair, wild as corn silk. It was almost a dozen years ago, long before I had formed even the most secret ambition to hold John's job myself. "If you don't have the courage to point," John White whispered, "you can't expect them to have the courage to convict." And so I point. I extend my hand across the courtroom. I hold one finger straight. I seek the defendant's eye. I say, "This man has been accused." He turns away, or blinks, or shows nothing at all. In the beginning, I was often preoccupied, imagining how it would feel to sit there, held at the focus of scrutiny, ardently denounced before all who cared to listen, knowing that the most ordinary privileges of a decent life, common trust, personal respect, and even liberty, were now like some cloak you had checked at the door and might never retrieve. I could feel the fear, the hot frustration, the haunted separateness. Now, like ore deposits, the harder stuff of duty and obligation has settled in the veins where those softer feelings moved. I have a job to do. It is not that I have grown uncaring, believe me, but this business of accusing, judging, punishing has gone on always. It is one of the great wheels turning beneath everything we do. I play my part. I am a functionary of our only universally recognized system of telling wrong from right, a bureaucrat of good and evil. This must be prohibited, not that. One would expect that after all these years of making charges, trying cases, watching defendants come and go, it might have all become a jumble. Somehow, it has not. I turn back to face the jury. Today, you, all of you, have taken on one of the most solemn obligations of citizenship. Your job is to find the facts, the truth. It is not an easy task, I know. Memories may fail, recollections may be shaded, the evidence might point in differing directions. You may be forced to decide about things that no one seems to know, or to be willing to say. If you were at home, at work, anywhere in your daily life, you might be ready to throw up your hands. You might not want to make the effort. Here, you must. You must. Let me remind you, there was a real crime. No one will dispute that. There was a real victim. Real pain. You do not have to tell us why it happened. People's motives, after all, may be forever locked inside them. But you must, at least, try to determine what actually occurred. If you cannot, we will not know if this man deserves to be freed or punished. We will have no idea who to blame. If we cannot find the truth, what is our hope of justice? Spring. Chapter 1.
I should feel sorrier, Raymond Horgan says.
I wonder at first if he is talking about the eulogy he is going to deliver. He has just looked over his notes again and is returning two index cards to the breast pocket of his blue serge suit. But when I catch his expression, I recognize that his remark was personal. From the rear seat of the county's Buick, he stares through the auto window toward the traffic thickening as we approach the south end. His look has taken on a meditative cast. As I watch him, it strikes me that this pose would have been effective as the picture for this year's campaign. Raymond's thick features fixed in an aspect of solemnity, courage, and a trace of sorrow. He shows something of the stoic air of this sometimes sad metropolis, like the soiled bricks and tar paper roofs of this part of town. It is a commonplace among those working around Raymond to say he does not look well. 20 months ago, he split with Anne, his wife of 30 years. He has picked up weight and a perpetual grimness of expression which suggests he has finally reached that time of life when he now believes that many painful things will not improve. A year ago, the wagering was that Raymond did not have the stamina or interest to run again, and he waited until 4 months before the primary to finally announce. Some say it was addiction to power and public life that made him proceed. I believe the chief impulse was Raymond's outright hatred of his primary opponent, Nico Della Guardia, who was until last year another deputy prosecuting attorney in our office. Whatever the motivation, it has proved a difficult campaign. While the money lasted, there were agencies involved and media consultants. Three young men of dubious sexuality dictated as to matters such as the picture, and saw to it that this image of Raymond was applied to the backside of one of every four buses in the city. In the picture, he has a coaxed smile, meant to show a toughened whimsy. I think the photograph makes him look like a kind of sap. It is one more sign that Raymond has fallen out of step. That is probably what he means when he says he should feel sorrier. He means that events seem to be slipping past him again. Raymond goes on talking about Carolyn Polhemus's death 3 nights ago on the 1st of April. It's as if I can't reach it. I have Nico on one side making out like I'm the one who murdered her, and every jackass in the world with press credentials wants to know when we're going to find the killer. And the secretaries are crying in the Johns. And in the end, you know, there's this woman to think about. Christ, I knew her as a probation officer before she graduated law school. She worked for me. I hired her. Smart, sexy girl. Hell of a lawyer. And you think about it eventually, you know, the actual event. I think I'm jaded, but Jesus. Some cretin breaks in there. And that's how she ends up. That's her au revoir. With some demented slug cracking her skull and giving her a jump? Jesus, Raymond says again. He can't feel sorry enough. No one broke in, I finally say. My sudden declarative tone surprises even me. Raymond, who has momentarily resumed his consideration of a lap full of papers brought along from the office, rears his head and fixes me with an astute gray eye. Where do you get that from? I'm slow to answer. We find the lady raped and bound, says Raymond. Offhand, I wouldn't be starting off my investigation with her friends and admirers. No broken windows, I say. No forced doors. At this point, Cody, the 30-year copper who is living out his last days on the force by driving Raymond's county car, breaks into the conversation from the front seat. Cody has been unusually quiet today, sparing us the customary reverie about the bum deals and good pinches he has witnessed in gross on most city avenues. Unlike Raymond, or for that matter me, he has no difficulty bringing himself to sorrow. He appears to have been without sleep, which gives his face an edge of roughened grief. My comment about the condition of Carolyn's apartment has stirred him for some reason. Every door and window in the joint was unlocked, he says. She liked it that way. That broad was living in Wonderland. I think somebody was being clever, I tell them both. I think that's misdirection. Come on, Rusty, Raymond says. We're looking for a bum. We don't need fucking Sherlock Holmes. Don't try to get ahead of the murder dicks.
Keep your head down and walk in a straight line, okay? Catch me a perpetrator and save my worthless ass. He smiles at me then, a warm, savvy look. Raymond wants me to know he's bearing up. Besides, there is no need to further emphasize the implications of catching Carolyn's killer. In his reported comments about Carolyn's death, Nico has been base and exploitative and relentless. The prosecuting attorney's lax approach to law enforcement for the last 12 years has made him the accomplice of the city's criminal elements. Even the members of his own staff are no longer safe, as this tragedy illustrates. Nico has not explained how his own hiring by Raymond as a deputy PA more than a decade ago fit into Raymond's liaison with lawlessness. But it is not the politician's lot to explain. Besides, Nico has always been shameless in his public conduct. That is one thing that made him ripe for a political career. Ripe or not, Nico is widely expected to lose the primary, now 18 days away. Raymond Horgan has wowed Kendall County's 1.5 million registered voters for better than a decade. This year he is yet to win the party endorsement, but that is largely due to an ancient factional dispute with the mayor. Raymond's political people, a group that has never included me, believe that when the first of the public polls are published in the next week and a half, other party leaders will be able to force the mayor to reverse field, and that Raymond will be safe for another quadrennium. In this one-party town, victory in the primary is tantamount to election. Cody turns back from the front seat and mentions that it is getting close to one. Raymond nods absently. Cody takes this for assent and reaches below the dash to let the siren go. He uses it in two brief spells, almost like punctuation in the traffic, but the cars and trucks park neatly and the dark Buick noses ahead. The neighborhood here is still marginal. Older shingle-sided houses, splintering porches. Kids with a kind of potato-y pallor play with balls and ropes at the edge of the street. I grew up about 3 blocks from here, in an apartment over my father's bakery. I recall them as dark years. During the day, my mother and I, when I was not at school, helped my father in the shop. At night, we stayed in one locked room while my father drank. There were no other children. The neighborhood today is not much different, still full of people like my father, Serbians as he was, Ukrainians, Italians, Poles, ethnic types who keep their peace and their own dim outlook. We are stopped dead in the heavy traffic of Friday afternoon. Cody has driven up the back end of a city bus, which emits its noxious fumes with an intestinal rumble. A Horgan campaign poster is right there, too, and Raymond looks out overhead, 6 feet wide, with the hapless expression of a TV talk show host or the spokesman for some canned cat food. And I cannot help myself. Raymond Horgan is my future and my past. I have been 12 years with him, years full of authentic loyalty and admiration. I am his second in command, and his fall would be my own. But there is no silencing the voice of discontent. It has its own imperatives, and it speaks now to the image overhead in a sudden forthright way. You sap, it says. You are, it says, a sap. As we turn down 3rd Street, I can see that the funeral has become an important event for the police department. Half the parked cars are black and whites, and there are cops in pairs and threes moving up and down the walks. Killing a prosecutor is only one step short of killing a cop, and whatever the institutional interests. Carolyn had many friends on the force, the sort of loyal lieges a good PA develops by appreciating skilled police work and making sure it is not squandered in court. Then, of course, there is the fact that she was a beautiful woman and one of modern temperament. Carolyn, we know, got around. Near the chapel, the traffic is hopelessly congested. We stutter only a few feet before waiting for the cars ahead to disgorge passengers. The vehicles are the very important. Limousines with official plates, press people looking for spaces nearby, clog the way with bovine indifference. The broadcast reporters in particular obey neither local ordinance nor the rules of common civility. The minicab van of one of the stations, complete with its rooftop radar dish, is parked on the sidewalk directly in front of the open oak doors of the chapel. And a number of reporters are working the crowd as if they were at a prize fight, thrusting microphones at arriving officials. Afterward, Raymond says, as he bulls through the press horde that encircles the car as soon as we finally reach the curb, he explains that he is going to make some remarks in eulogy, which he will repeat again outside. He pauses long enough to pet Stanley Rosenberg from Channel 5. Stanley, as usual, will get the first interview. Paul Dry, from the mayor's staff, is motioning to me. His honor, it seems, would like a word with Raymond before the service begins. I relay the message just as Horgan is pulling free of the reporters. He makes a face, unwisely, for Dry can certainly see it, before he walks off with Paul, disappearing into the gothic dark of the church. The mayor, Augustin Bolcaro, has the character of a tyrant. 10 years ago, when Raymond Horgan was the hot face in town, he almost ran Bolcaro out of office. Almost. Since losing that primary, Raymond has made all the appropriate gestures of fealty, but Bolcaro still feels the ache of his old wounds. Now that it is, at last, Raymond's turn to endure a contested primary, the mayor has claimed that his party role demands neutrality, and he has designed to withhold the party's endorsement as well. Clearly he is enjoying watching Raymond struggle on his own toward shore. When Horgan finally hits the beach, Augie will be the first to greet him, saying he knew Raymond was a winner all along. Inside, the pews are already largely occupied. At the front, the bier is ringed with flowers, lilies and white dahlias, and I imagine, notwithstanding all the bodies, a vague floral scent on the air. I make my way forward, nodding to various personages and shaking hands. It is a heavyweight crowd, all the city and county palls. Most of the judges are here. Most of the bright lights of the defense bar, a number of the leftish and feminist groups with whom Carolyn was sometimes aligned, are also represented. The talk is appropriately low-key, expressions of shock and loss sincere. I back into DeLaGuardia, who is also working the crowd. Nico! I shake his hand. He has a flower in his lapel, a habit he has acquired since becoming a candidate. He asks after my wife and son, but he does not await my answer. Instead, he assumes a sudden look of tragical sobriety and begins to speak of Carolyn's death. She was just... He circles his hand for the word. I realize that the dashing candidate for prosecuting attorney aspires to poetry, and I cut him off. She was splendid, I say, and am momentarily amazed by my sudden rush of sentiment and the force and speed with which it has wrenched itself from some hidden inner place. Splendid, that's it. Very good, Nico nods. Then some mercurial shadow passes across his face. I know him well enough to recognize that he has found a thought which he believes is to his advantage. I imagine Raymond's pressing pretty hard on that case. Raymond Horgan presses hard on every case. You know that.
Oh-ho!
I always thought you were the one who was non-political, Rusty. You're picking up your lines now from Raymond's copywriters. Better than yours, Delay. Nico acquired that nickname while we were both new deputy PAs working in the appellate section. Nico never could complete a brief on time. John White, the old chief deputy, called him Unavoidable Delay Guardia.
Oh, no, he says. You fellows aren't angry with me, are you, for what I've been saying? Because I believe that. I believe that effective law enforcement starts right at the top. I believe that's true. Raymond's soft. He's tired. He doesn't have it left to be tough.
I met Nico a dozen years ago, on my first day as a deputy PA, when we were assigned to share an office. 11 years later, I was the chief deputy, and he was head of the homicide section, and I fired him. By then, he had begun overtly attempting to run Raymond out of office. There was a black physician, an abortionist, whom Nico wanted to prosecute for murder. His position made no sense as a matter of law, but it excited the passions of various interest groups whose support he sought. Nico planted news stories about his disagreements with Raymond. He made jury arguments, for which abundant press coverage always was arranged, that were little more than campaign speeches. Raymond left the final act to me. One morning I went to Kmart and bought the cheapest pair of running shoes they had. I centered them on Nico's desk with a note, "Goodbye. Good luck. Rusty." I always knew campaigning was going to suit him. He looks good.
Nico Della Guardia is about 40 now, a man of medium height, fastidiously trim. He has been concerned about his weight, eating red meat, things like that, as long as I've known him. Although his skin is bad and his coloring peculiar, red hair and olive skin and light eyes, he has the sort of face whose imperfections are not detected by a camera or even across a courtroom, and he is uniformly regarded as handsome. Certainly he has always dressed the part. Even in the days when it required half his paycheck, his suits were tailor-made. But far beyond good looks, Nico's most arresting aspect has always been the brassy and indiscriminate sincerity he is displaying here, reciting the elements of his platform while conversing, in the midst of a funeral, with his opponent's chief assistant. After 12 years, including 2 in which we shared an office, I have learned that Delay can always summon up that kind of overeager and unreflective faith in himself. The morning that I fired him, 9 months ago, he strolled past my office on his way out, bright as a new penny, and said simply, "I'll be back." I try to let Nico down easy now. "It's too late, Delay. I promised my vote to Raymond Horgan." He is slow to get the joke, and when he does, he will not give the subject up. We go on playing a sort of lawyer's dozens, dwelling on weaknesses. Nico admits his campaign is short of money, but claims that the Archbishop's unspoken support lends him moral capital. "That's where we're strong," he says. "Really, that's where we'll pick up votes. People have forgotten why they ever wanted to vote for civil rights Raymond. He's just a blur to them, a blob. I have a strong, clear message." Nico's confidence is radiant, as ever, when he speaks about himself. "You know what worried me?" Nico asks. "You know who would have been hard to beat?" He has crept a foot closer and lowered his voice. "You." I laugh out loud, but Nico goes on. "I was relieved. I'm telling you the truth. I was relieved when Raymond announced. I'd seen it coming. Horgan holds a big press conference, says he's hanging it up, but he's asked his top assistant to carry on. Media is going to love Rusty Sabich. A non-political guy, a professional prosecutor, stable, mature, somebody everyone can depend on, the man who broke up the Night Saints. They play all that stuff, and Raymond brings Bolcaro in behind you. You'd have been tough, very tough." "Ridiculous," I say, manfully pretending that like scenarios have not described themselves to my imagination on 100 occasions in the last year. "You're really something, Delay," I tell him. "Divide and conquer. You'll just never stop." "Hey, listen, my friend," he says. "I am one of your true admirers. I mean that. There are no hard feelings here." He touches his shirt above the vest. "That is one of the few things that's going to stay the same when I get there. You'll still be in the chief deputy's office." I tell him affably, "That's a bunch of crap." "You'll never be PA," I say. "And if you were, Tommy Molto would be your guy. Everybody knows you have Tommy in the woodshed now." Tommy Molto is Nico's best friend, his former second-in-command in the homicide section. Molto has been a no-show in the office for 3 days. He hasn't called in, and his desk is clean. The common belief is that when the furor over Carolyn's death abates a bit next week, Nico will stage another media occasion and announce that Tommy has joined his campaign. It will provoke a few more headlines. "Disappointed Horgan deputy backs Nico." Delay handles these things well. Raymond has a fit whenever he hears Tommy's name. "Molto?" Nico asks me now. His look of innocence is entirely unconvincing. But I do not get the chance to respond. At the lectern, the Reverend has asked the mourners to assume their seats. Instead, I smile at Della Guardia, smirk, in fact, as we are parting, and begin buffeting my way toward the front of the chapel where Raymond and I are supposed to sit as office representatives. But as I go, making restrained gestures of acknowledgement to the people I know, the heat of all of Nico's forceful confidence is still upon me. It is like having come in out of the blazing sun. The skin tingles and remains tender to the touch. And it strikes me then, abruptly, as I gain my first clear view of the pewter-colored casket, that Nico Della Guardia actually may win. This prophecy is announced by a small voice somewhere in my interior reaches, only loud enough, like some whining conscience, to tell me what I do not want to hear.
undeserving as Nico is, unqualified, a pygmy in his soul, something may be propelling him toward triumph. Here, in this region of the dead, I cannot help but recognize the carnal appeal of his vitality, and how far it is bound to take him. In keeping with the character of this public occasion, two rows of folding chairs have been positioned next to Carolyn's coffin. They are occupied, for the most part, by the dignitaries you would expect. The only unfamiliar figure is a boy in his late teens who is seated beside the mayor, directly at the foot of the bier. This young man has a poorly barbered tangle of blondish hair and a necktie drawn too tight so that the collar points on his rayon shirt are lifted in the air. A cousin, I decide, perhaps a nephew, but definitely, and surprisingly, family. Carolyn's people, as I understood it, were all back east, where she meant to leave them long ago. Beside him in the front row there are more of the mayor's people than there should be, and no room is left for me. As I pass in the row behind Horgan, Raymond leans back. He has apparently observed my talk with Delaguardia.
What did Delay have to say for himself?
Nothing. Bullshit. He's running out of money.
Who isn't?
Raymond asks. I inquire about the meeting with the mayor, and Horgan rolls his eyes.
He wanted to give me some advice, just in confidence, me and him, because he doesn't want to appear to be taking sides. He thinks it would help my chances a lot if we arrested Carolyn's murderer before Election Day. Can you believe that jagoff? And he said it with a straight face, too, so I couldn't walk out on him. He's having a great time, Raymond points. Look at him up there, the chief mourner.
Raymond, as usual, cannot contain himself about Bolcaro. I look around, hoping we have not been overheard. I chuck my face toward the young man seated beside the mayor.
Who is the kid? I ask.
I do not think I have understood Horgan's answer, and I lean closer. Raymond brings his face right to my ear.
Her son,
he says again. I stand up straight.
Grew up with his father in New Jersey, Raymond says. Then came out here for college. He's over at the U.
Surprise seems to drive me backward. I murmur something to Raymond and push down the road toward my seat at the end, between two sizable floral arrangements on pedestals. For an instant, I am certain that this light-headed moment of shock has passed, but as an unexpectedly bold tone forges from the organ immediately behind me and the Reverend speaks his first words of address, my amazement deepens, ripples, and somehow takes on the infected hurt of real sorrow. I did not know. I feel a sort of shimmering incomprehension. It does not seem plausible that she could have kept a fact like this to herself. The husband I had long ago surmised, but she never made mention of a child, let alone one nearby. And I must stifle an immediate instinct to leave, to remove myself from this theater darkness for the sobering effect of strong light. As a matter of will, I urge myself after a few moments to attend to what is present. Raymond has arrived at the podium. There has been no formal introduction. Others, the Reverend Mr. Hiller, Rita Wirth from the Women's Bar Association, have spoken briefly. But now a sudden gravity and portentousness comes into the air, a current strong enough to wrest me from my sense of grievance. The hundreds here grow stiller. Raymond Horgan has his shortcomings as a politician, but he is a consummate public man, a speaker, a presence. Balding, growing stout, standing there in his fine blue suit, he broadcasts his anguish and his power like a beaconed emission. His remarks are anecdotal. He recalls Carolyn's hiring over the objections of more hard-bitten prosecutors who regarded probation officers as social workers. He celebrates her toughness and her flint. He remembers cases that she won, judges she defied, archaic rules she took pleasure in seeing broken. From Raymond, these stories have a soulful wit, a sweet melancholy for Carolyn, and all of her lost courage. He really has no equal in a setting like this, just talking to people about what he thinks and feels. For me, though, there is no quick recovery from the disorder of the moments before. I find all of it, the hurt, the shock, the piercing force of Raymond's words, my deep, my unspeakable sorrow, welling up, pushing at the limits of tolerance and a composure I desperately need to maintain. I bargain with myself. I will not go to the interment. There is work to do, and the office will be represented. The secretaries and clerks, the older ladies who always criticize Carolyn's airs and are here now crying in the front rows, will be pressed close at the graveside, weeping over one more of life's endless desolations. I will let them observe Carolyn's disappearance into open ground. Raymond finishes. The impressive register of his performance, witnessed by so many who regard him as beleaguered, sets a palpable stir in the auditorium as he strides toward his seat. The Reverend recites the details of the burial, but I let that pass. I am resolved. I will go back to the office. As Raymond wishes, I will resume the search for Carolyn's killer. Nobody will mind. Least of all, I think, Carolyn herself. I have already paid her my respects. Too much so, she might say. Too often. She knows, I know, that I have already done my grieving over Carolyn Polhemus. Chapter 2. The office has the bizarre air of calamity, of things badly out of place. The halls are empty, but the phones are pealing in wearying succession. Two secretaries, the only ones who stayed behind, are sprinting up and down the corridors, putting callers on hold. Even in the best of times, the office of the Kendall County Prosecuting Attorney has a dismal aspect. Most deputies work two to an office in a space of Dickensian grimness. The Kendall County building was erected in 1897 in the emerging institutional style of factories and high schools. It is a solid red brick block dressed up with a few Doric columns to let everybody know it is a public place. Inside, there are transoms over the doors and dour casement windows. The walls are that mossy hospital green. Worst of all is the light, a kind of yellow fluid like old shellac. So here we are, 200 harried individuals attempting to deal with every crime committed in a city of 1 million, and the surrounding county, where 2 million people more reside. In the summer, we labor in jungle humidity, with the old window units rattling over the constant clamor of the telephones. In the winter, the radiators spit and clank while the hint of darkness never seems to leave the daylight. Justice in the Middle West. In my office, LaPranzer is waiting for me like a bad guy in a Western, hidden as he sits behind the door. "Everybody dead and gone?" he asks. I comment on his sentimentality and throw my coat down on a chair. "Where were you, by the way? Any copper with 5 years' service showed?" "I'm no funeral goer," LaPranzer says dryly. There is, I decide, some significance in a homicide dick's distaste for funerals, but the connection does not come to me immediately, and so I let the idea go. Life in the workplace. So many signs of the hidden world of meanings elude me in a day, bumps on the surface, shadows, like creatures darting by. I attend to what is present. On my desk there are two items. A memo from MacDougall, the chief administrative deputy, and an envelope LaPranzer has placed there. Mac's memo simply says, "Where is Tommy Molto?" It occurs to me that for all of our suspicions of political intrigue, we should not ignore the obvious. Someone ought to check the hospitals and Tommy's apartment. One deputy PA is dead already. That is the reason for LaPranzer's envelope. It bears a label typed by the police lab. Offender unknown. Victim C. Polhemus. "Did you know that our decedent left an heir?" I ask as I'm looking for the letter opener. "No shit," says Lip. "A kid, looked to be 18, 20. He was at the funeral." "No shit," Lip says again and considers his cigarette. "You figure one thing about going to a funeral is at least no surprises." "One of us ought to talk to him. He's at the U." "Get me an address. I'll see him." "Anything Horgan's guys want. Morano gave me that crock again this morning." Morano's the police chief, an ally of Bolcaro's. He's waiting to see Raymond fall on his ass. "Him and Nico. I bumped into DeLay." I tell Lip about our visit. "Nico's really high on himself. He even made me believe it for a minute." "He'll do better than people say. Then you'll be kicking yourself in the ass.
thinking you should have run. I make a face. Who knows? With Lip, I do not have to bother with more. For my 15th college reunion, I received a questionnaire which asked a lot of personal questions I found difficult to answer. What contemporary American do you admire most? What is your most important physical possession? Name your best friend and describe him. On this one, I puzzled for some time, but I finally wrote down LaPranzer's name. My best friend, I wrote, is a cop. He is 5'8" tall, weighs 120 pounds after a full meal, and has a duck-ass hairdo and that look of lurking, small-time viciousness that you've seen on every no-account kid hanging on a street corner. He smokes 2 packs of Camel cigarettes a day. I do not know what we have in common, but I admire him. He is very good at what he does. I first ran across Lip 7 or 8 years ago, when I was initially assigned to the violence section and he had just begun working homicide. We have done 12 cases since, but there are still ways in which I regard him as a mystery, even a danger. His father was a watch commander in a precinct in the West End, and when his old man died, Lip left college to take up a place that came to him by rights of a kind of departmental primogeniture. By now, he had been placed in the PA's office on direct assignment, a so-called special command. On paper, his job is to act as police liaison, coordinating homicide investigations of special interest to our office. In practice, he is as solitary as a shooting star. He reports to a Captain Schmidt, who cares only that he has 16 homicide collars to show at the end of every fiscal year. Lip spends most of this time alone, hanging out in bars and on loading docks, drinking shots with anybody who's got good information. Hoods, reporters, queers, federal agents, anybody who can keep him up to speed on the world of big-time bad guys. LaPranzer is a scholar of the underlife. Eventually, I have come to recognize that it is the weird weight of that information that somehow accounts for his rheumy-eyed, sulking look. I still have the envelope in my hands. "So what do we have here?" I ask. "Path report. 3-sheet. Bunch of pictures of a naked dead lady." The 3-sheet is the prosecutor's copy of the arriving officer's reports, the 3rd leaf in the carbon layers. I have talked to these cops directly. I go on to the report of the police pathologist, Dr. Kumagai, a weird-looking little Japanese who seems to have come out of a 40s propaganda piece. He is known as Painless, a notorious hack. No prosecutor calls him to the witness stand without crossing his fingers. "And what's the scoop? Male fluids in every hole?" "Just the main one. Lady is dead of a skull fracture and resulting hemorrhage. Pictures might make you think she was strangled, but Painless says there was air in her lungs. Anyway, the guy must have hit her with something. Painless has got no idea what. Heavy, he says, and real hard." "I take it we look for a murder weapon in the apartment. Turn the place upside down." "Anything obvious missing? Candlesticks? Bookends?" "Nothing. I sent 3 separate teams through." "So," I say, "our man showed up already thinking he'd be doing some heavy hitting." "Could be. Or else he just took what he used with him. I'm not positive this guy came prepared. Seems like he was hitting to subdue her. Didn't realize he cooled her. I figure, you can see when you look at the pictures, that the way the ropes were tied, that he put himself between her legs and was trying to let his weight strangle her. It's all slipknotted. I mean, LaPranzer says, that he was sort of trying to fuck her to death."
"Charming," I say.
"Definitely charming," says Lip. "This is a very charming type fellow." We are both quiet a moment before he goes on. "We got no bruises on the arms, hands, nothing like that," Lip says. "That would mean there was no struggle before Carolyn was bound." "Contusions, rear right. It's got to be that he hit her from behind, then tied her up. Only it seems strange that he would knock her cold to start with. Most of these creeps like him to know what they're doing." I shrug. I'm not so sure of that. The photos are the first thing I take out of the envelope. They're clean, full-colored shots. Carolyn lived in a place on the waterfront, a former warehouse parceled into loft condominiums. She had divided the space with Chinese screens and heavy rugs. Her taste ran to the modern,
with elegant touches of classical and antique. She had been killed in the space off the kitchen, which she used as a living room. An overall shot of that area is first on the stack. The thick, green-edged glass top of a coffee table has been tumbled off its brass props. A modular seating piece is upside down. But overall, I agree with Lip that there is less sign of struggle than I have seen on other occasions, particularly if you ignore the bloodstain worked into the fiber of the Flocati rug so that it has the shape of a large, soft cloud. I look up. I do not feel that I am ready yet to take on the photos of the corpse. "What else does Painless tell us?" I ask.
"This guy was shooting blanks."
"Blanks? Oh, yeah. You'll like this." Lepranzer does his best to repeat Kumagai's analysis of the sperm deposit that was found. Little of it had seeped to the labia, which means that Carolyn could not have spent much time on her feet after sexual contact. This is another way we know that the rape and her death were roughly contemporaneous. On April 1st, she had left the office a little after 7. Kumagai puts the time of death at somewhere around 9.
"That's 12 hours before the body's found," Lip says. "Painless says normally with that kind of time span, he'd still see some of the guy's little thingies swimming upstream in the tubes and in the womb when he looked under the microscope. Instead, this guy's wad is all dead. Nothing went nowhere. Painless figures this guy is sterile."
Lip pronounces the word so that it rhymes with pearl.
"Says you can get like that from mumps."
"So we're looking for a rapist who has no children and once had the mumps." Lepranzer shrugs.
"Painless says he's going to take the semen specimen and send it over to the forensic chemist. Maybe they can give him another idea of what's up."
I groan a little bit at the thought of Painless exploring the realms of higher chemistry. "Can't we get a decent pathologist?" I ask.
"You got Painless,"
Lip says innocently. I groan again and leaf through a few more pages of Kumagai's report.
"Do we have a secretor?"
I ask. People are divided not merely by blood type, but by whether they secrete identifying agents into their body fluids. Lip takes the report from me.
"Yep.
Blood type?
A."
"Ah," I say, "my very own."
"I thought of that," says Lip. "But you got a kid."
I again comment on Lepranzer's sentimentality. He does not bother to respond. Instead, he lights another cigarette and shakes his head.
"I'm just not grabbing it yet," he says. "The whole goddamn deal is too weird. We're missing something."
So we begin again, the investigator's favorite parlor game, who and why. Lepranzer's number one suspicion from the start has been that Carolyn was killed by someone she convicted. That is every prosecutor's worst fantasy, the long-nurtured vengeance of some dip you sent away. Shortly after I was first assigned to the jury trial section, a youth, as the papers would have it, by the name of Pancho Mercado, took exception to my closing argument, in which I had questioned the manliness of anyone who made his living by pistol-whipping 77-year-old men. 6'4" and well over 250 pounds, Pancho leaped the dock and thundered behind me through most of the courthouse before he was stopped cold in the PA's lunchroom by MacDougall, wheelchair and all. The whole thing ended up on page 3 of the Tribune with a grotesque headline, "Panicked Prosecutor Saved by Cripple," something like that. Barbara, my wife, likes to refer to this as my first famous case. Carolyn worked on stranger types than Pancho. For several years, she had headed what is called the office's rape section. The name gives a good idea of what is involved, although all forms of sexual assault tend to be prosecuted there, including child abuse. And one case I can recall where an all-male ménage à trois had turned rough, and the state's main witness had ended the evening with a light bulb up his rectum. It is Lepranzer's hypothesis at moments that one of the rapists Carolyn prosecuted got even. Accordingly, we agreed to go over Carolyn's docket to see if there was anybody she tried or investigated for a crime resembling what took place 3 nights ago. I promised to look through the records in Carolyn's office. The state investigative agencies also maintain a computer run of sexual offenders, and Lip will see if we can cross-match there on Carolyn's name or the stunt with the ropes. What kind of leads are we running? Lepranzer begins to tick it off for me. The neighbors were all seen in the day following the murder, but those interviews were probably hasty, and Lip will arrange for homicide investigators to make another pass at everyone in a square block. This time they'll do it in the evening, so that the neighbors who are home at the hour when the murder took place will be in. One lady says she saw a guy in a raincoat on the stairs. Lip looks at his notebook. Mrs. Kropotnik says maybe he looked familiar, but she doesn't think he lives there. The hair and fiber guys went through first, right? I ask. When do we hear from them? To these people falls the grotesque duty of vacuuming the corpse, picking over the crime scene with tweezers in order to make microscopic examinations of any trace materials they discover. Often they can type hair, identify an offender's clothing. That should be a week, 10 days, Lip says. They'll try to come up with something on the rope. Only other interesting thing, they tell me, is they got a lot of floor fluff. There are a few hairs around, but not what you'd find if there was any kind of fight. How about fingerprints, I ask. They dusted everything in the place. Did they dust this glass table here? I show Lip the picture. Yeah. Did they get latents? Yeah. Report? Preliminary. Whose prints? Carolyn Pohemus. Super. It ain't all bad, says Lip. He takes the picture from me and points. See this bar here? See the glass? One tall bar glass standing undisturbed. There are latents on that. 3 fingers. And the prints ain't the decedent's. Do we have any idea whose prints they are? No. Identification says 3 weeks. They got all kind of backlogs. The Police Department Identification Division keeps a digit-by-digit record of every person who has ever been printed, classified by so-called points of comparison, the ridges and valleys on a fingertip to which numerical values are assigned. In the old days, they were unable to identify an unknown print unless the subject left behind latents of all 10 fingers, so ID could search the existing catalog. Now, in the computer era, the search can be done by machine. A laser mechanism reads the print and compares to everyone in memory. The process takes only a few minutes. But the department, due to budgetary constraints, does not yet own all of the equipment and must borrow pieces from the state police for special cases. I told them to rush it up, but they're giving me all that shit about Zillogs and onloading. A call from the PA would really help. Tell them to compare to every known in the county. Anybody, any dirtball who's ever been printed. I make a note to myself. We need muds, too, LePranzer says and points to the pad. Although it is not well known, the telephone company keeps a computerized record of all local calls made from most exchanges. Message unit detail sheets. I begin writing out the grand jury subpoena duces tecum, a request for documents. And ask them for muds on anybody she called in the last 6 months, says Lip. They'll scream. You're probably talking about 200 numbers. Anybody she called 3 times. I'll get back to them with a list. But ask for it now, so I'm not running my ass around trying to find you to do another subpoena. I nod. I'm thinking. If you're going back 6 months, I tell him, you're probably going to hit this number. I nod toward the phone on my desk. LePranzer looks at me levelly and says, I know. So he knows, I think. I take a minute with this, trying to figure him. People guess, I think. They gossip. Besides, Lip would notice things that anyone else would miss. I doubt that he approves. He is single, but he is no rover. There is a Polish woman a good 10 years older than he, a widow with a grown kid who cooks a meal and sleeps with LePranzer 2 or 3 times a week. On the phone, he calls her Mama. You know, I say, as long as we're on the subject, Carolyn always locked her doors and windows. I tell him this with admirable evenness. I mean, always. She was a little soft, but Carolyn was a grown-up. She knew she lived in the city. LePranzer's look focuses gradually, and his eyes take on a metallic gleam. He has not lost the significance of what I'm telling him, or, it seems, of the fact that I delayed. So, what do you figure? He asks at last. Somebody walked around there opening the windows? Could be.
so they make it look like a break-in. Somebody she let in the first place? Doesn't that make sense? You're the one who's telling me there's a glass on the bar. She was entertaining. I wouldn't bet the ranch on the bad guy being some crazed parolee.
Lip stares at his cigarette. Looking through the doorway, I see that Eugenia, my secretary, has returned. There are voices now in the hallway as people filter back in from the graveside. I detect a lot of the anxious laughter of release.
"Not necessarily," he says finally. "Not with Carolyn Polhemus. She was a funny lady."
He looks at me hard again.
"You mean you think she'd open the door to some bum she sent to jail?"
"I think with Carolyn there's no telling.
Suppose she bumped into one of these characters in a bar. Or some guy called her up and said, 'Let's have a pop.'
You think there's no chance she'd say yes?"
We're talking Carolyn now.
I can see where Lip is going. Lady PA, prosecutor of perverts, fucks defendant and lives out forbidden fantasy. Lip has got her number pretty well. Carolyn Polhemus would not have minded at all the idea that some guy had dwelled with the thought of her for years. But somehow, with this discussion, a seasick misery begins to ebb through me.
"You didn't like her much, did you, Lip?"
"Not much."
We look at each other. Then LaPranza reaches over and chucks me on the knee.
"At least we know one thing," he says. "She had piss-poor taste in men."
That is his exit line. He tucks his camels into his windbreaker and is gone. I call out to Eugenia to please hold anything else. With a moment's privacy, I am now ready to examine the photographs. For a minute, after I begin sorting through them, my attention is mostly on myself. How well will I manage this? I urge myself to maintain professional composure. But that, of course, begins to give way. It is like the network of crazing that sometimes seeps through glass in the wake of an impact. There is excitement at first, slow entering and reluctant, but more than a little. In the top photographs, the heavy glass of the table is canted over, compressing her shoulder, so that you might almost make the comparison to a laboratory slide. But soon it is removed, and here is Carolyn's spectacularly lithe body in a pose which, for all the agony there must have been, seems initially supple and athletic. Her legs are trim and graceful. Her breasts are high and large. Even in death, she retains her erotic bearing. But I slowly recognize other experiences must influence this response, because what is actually here is horrible. There are bruises on her face and neck, mulberry patches. A rope runs from her ankles to her knees, her waist, her wrists. Then it is jerked tight around her neck, where the rim of the burn is visible. She is drawn back in an ugly, tormented bow, and her face is ghastly. Her eyes, with the hyperthyroid look of the attempted strangulation, are enormous and protruding, and her mouth is fixed in a silent scream. I watch. I study. Her look holds the same wild, disbelieving, desperate thing that so frightens me when I find the courage to let my glance fix on the wide, black eye of a landed fish dying on a pier. I take it in now in the same reverential, awestruck, uncomprehending way. And then, worst of all, when all the dirt is scraped off the treasure box, there is rising within, unhindered by shame or even fear, a bubble of something light enough that I must eventually recognize it as satisfaction. And no lecture to myself about the baseness of my nature can quite discourage me. Carolyn Polhemus, that tower of grace and fortitude, lies here in my line of sight with a look she never had in life. I see it finally now. She wants my pity. She needs my help.
Chapter 3.
When it was all over, I went to see a psychiatrist. His name was Robinson. "I would say she's the most exciting woman I've known," I told him.
"Sexy?" he asked after a moment.
"Sexy, yes.
Very sexy. torrents of blonde hair and almost no behind, and this very full bosom. And long red fingernails, too. I mean, definitely, deliberately, almost ironically sexy. You notice. That's the idea with Carolyn. You're supposed to notice. And I did. She's worked around our office for years. She was a probation officer before she went to law school. But that's all she was to me originally. You know, this very good-looking blonde with big tits. Every copper who came in would roll his eyes and make like he was jerking off. That's all. Over time, people began to talk about her, even while she was still in the branch courts. You know, high-powered, capable. Then for a while, she was dating this newsman on Channel 3, Chet, whatever his name is, and she showed up a lot of places, very active in the bar organizations, an officer for a while in the local Now chapter, and shrewd. She asked to be assigned out to the rape section when it was considered a crappy place to work. All these impossible one-on-ones where you could never figure out if it was the victim or the defendant who was closer to the truth. Hard cases. Just to find the ones that deserved to be prosecuted, let alone to win them. And she did very well out there. Eventually, Raymond put her in charge of all those trials. He liked to send her on those Sunday morning public service TV programs, show his concern on women's issues. And Carolyn liked to go and carry the banner. She enjoyed the limelight. But she was a good prosecutor, and damn tough. The defense lawyers used to complain that she had a complex, that she was trying to prove that she had balls. But the coppers loved her. I'm not sure what I thought of her then. I suppose I thought she was just a little bit too much. Robinson looked at me. Too much everything, I said. You know, too bold, too self-impressed, always running one gear too high. She didn't have the right sense of proportion. And, said Robinson, proceeding to the obvious, you fell in love with her. I went silent, still. When are words ever enough? I fell in love with her, I said. Raymond felt she needed a partner, and so she asked me. It was September of last year. Could you have said no? Asked Robinson. I suppose. The chief deputy isn't expected to try a lot of cases. I could have said no. But? But I said yes. Because I told myself the case was interesting. The case was strange. Daryl McGaffin was a banker. He worked for his brother Joey, who was a gangster, a florid personality, a hotshot type who enjoyed being the target of every law enforcement agency in town. Joey used the bank out on McCrary to wash a river of dirty money, mostly mob dough. But that was Joey's action. Daryl kept his head down and the accounts straight. Daryl was as mild as Joey was flamboyant, an ordinary guy. He lived out west near McCrary. He had a wife and a somewhat tragic life. His first child, a little girl, had died at the age of 3. I knew all about that because Joey had once testified before the grand jury about his niece's fall from a second-floor terrace at his brother's home. Joey had explained, almost convincingly, that the girl's resulting skull fracture and immediate death were large in his mind, and had obstructed his judgment when 4 mysterious fellows delivered to his bank certain bonds, which, to Joey's great chagrin, turned out to be hot. Joey wrung his hands when he talked about the girl. He touched his silk pocket hanky to both his eyes. Daryl and his wife had another child, a boy named Wendell. When Wendell was 5, his mother arrived with him at the West End Pavilion Hospital emergency room. The boy was unconscious, and his mother was hysterical, for her child had taken a terrible fall, sustaining severe head injuries. The mother claimed that he had never been at the hospital before, but the emergency room physician, a young Indian woman, Dr. Naraji, had a memory of treating Wendell a year earlier, and when a medical record was summoned, she found he had been there twice, once with a broken collarbone, once with a broken arm, both the results, his mother had said, of falls. The child was unconscious now and not likely, in most events, to speak, and so Dr. Naraji studied his injuries. When she testified later, Dr. Naraji said she realized initially that the wounds were too symmetrical and too evenly positioned laterally to be the result of a fall. She repeatedly examined the gashes, 2 inches by 1 inch on each side of the head,
over more than a day before she had it all figured out, and then she called Carolyn Polhemus at the prosecuting attorney's office to report that she was treating a child whose skull appeared to have been fractured when his mother placed his head in a vise. Carolyn obtained a search warrant at once. They recovered the grip with skin fragments still on it from the basement of the McGaffin home. They examined the unconscious child and found healed wounds which appeared to have been cigarette burns in his anus. And then they waited to see what would happen with the boy. He lived. By then, he was in court custody, and the PA's office was under siege. Daryl McGaffin came to his wife's defense. She was a loving and devoted mother. It was insanity, he said, to claim she'd hurt her child. He had seen the boy fall, McGaffin said, a terrible accident, a tragedy, marred by this nightmarish experience of doctors and lawyers madly conspiring to take their sick child away. Very emotional. Very well staged. Joey made sure the cameras were there when the brother got to the courthouse and that Daryl claimed a vendetta by Raymond Horgan against his family. In order to show forthrightness, Raymond was going to try the case himself at first. But the campaign was beginning to heat up. Raymond sent the case back to Carolyn and recommended, given the press attention, that she try it with another senior deputy, someone like me, whose presence would show the office's commitment. So she asked, and I agreed. I told myself I was doing it for Raymond. The physicists call it Brownian movement, the action of molecules coursing against one another in the air. This activity produces a kind of hum, a high-pitched, almost screeching sound at a frequency level on the margins of human audibility. As a child, I could hear this tone, if I chose to, at virtually any moment. Most often I would ignore it, but every now and then my will eroded and I would let the pitch rise inside my ears to the point where it was almost blaring. Apparently, at puberty, the bones in the inner ear harden so that the Brownian ringing can no longer be heard, which is just as well, because by then there are other distractions. For me, during most of my married life, the allure of other women has been like that daily hum which I willfully ignored. And when I started working around Carolyn, that resolve went weak, and the pitch rose, vibrated, sang. "And I can't really tell you why," I said to Robinson. "I consider myself a person of values. I had always despised my father for his philandering. On Friday nights, he was emitted from the household like a wandering cat, headed for a tavern, and later the Hotel Delaney, over on Western Avenue, only a little better than a flop, with its old woolen carpets worn to the backing over the stairs, and the naphtha scent of some chemical agent used to control the infestation of pests. There he would pursue his passion with various soiled women, barroom chippies, horny divorcees, wives out on the sneak. Before he left on these outings, he had dinner with my mother and me. We both knew where he was going. He would hum, the only sound anything like music which came from him all week. But somehow as I worked around Carolyn, with her jangling jewelry and her light perfume, her silk blouses, her red lipstick and painted nails, that large heaving bosom, and her long legs, that splash of bright hair, I became overwhelmed by her, and in just that fashion, detail by detail, so that I would become excited when I smelled her scent on another woman who passed me in the hall. And I can't really tell you why. Maybe that's why I am here. Some frequency is heard and everything begins to shatter. A vibration sets in, a fundamental tone, and the whole interior is shaking. We talk about the trial, our lives, whatever, and she seemed such a remarkable mix of things. Symphonic. A symphonic personality. Disciplined and glamorous. This musical laugh. And an orthodontic wonder of a smile. She was much wittier than I expected. Tough, as they said. But she did not seem hard. I was affected particularly by her offhand remarks, the way her eyes, hooded with shadow and liner, would take on this tone of level assessment. Analyzing politics or witnesses or cops, she showed you just how firm a purchase she had on what was going on. and that was very exciting to me, to meet a woman who seemed to really have the lowdown, who was moving through the world at Carolyn's speed, and who was so many different things to different people. Maybe it was a contrast to Barbara, who was so deliberately none of that. Here was this bold, bright, handsome woman, much celebrated with a kind of spotlight radiance, and I find I am going down to her office, which is itself a minor wonder in a place as stark as ours, Carolyn having taken the trouble to add a small oriental rug, plants, an antique bookcase, and an Empire desk she snagged through a connection with Central Services. I'm going down there with nothing to say. There is this heat, this parched sensation, all the old crappy metaphors. And I start thinking, Jesus Christ, this can't be happening. And maybe it still wouldn't have, but about this time I begin to think she is paying attention to me. She's looking at me. Oh, I know, this sounds like high school. No, worse, junior high school. But there is this thing, people don't look at one another. And when we're interviewing witnesses, I turn and Carolyn is staring at me, watching with this placid, almost rueful smile as I do my stuff. Or in a meeting with Raymond, all the top felony people, I'll glance up, I'll feel the weight of her eyes on me, and she continues watching me in such an unwavering fashion that I do something, a wink, a smile, as a form of acknowledgement, and she responds. Usually that little cat's grin, and if I'm speaking, I stop. Everything washes out of my mind.